having that sense of community and like people to teach you is important because you really just can't do it yourself. It's like all of this comes from hundreds of years of knowledge and that your ancestors learned and whatnot. So when you have that broken line, that's when these traditions start to die.
Buenos dias. Welcome to Eco Village Library. I am your host, Christopher Kinney, and give it up for those incredible beats by my good old brother, Michael Kinney. So go ahead and show him some love and check out his platform provided as links in the description below. Now listen, I know how much the world has changed since the last episode I produced, but it doesn't no matter what the headlines are saying, because what matters most now, more than ever before, is your connection with spirit, your spiritual connection. As the Maori proverb has said, turn your face toward the sun, and the shadows will fall behind you. You know, it's the sun that's real. Don't get too caught up in the illusions and fixating on the shadows casted behind you in the darkness that it portrays. Instead, face boldly towards the light, towards the warmth of the sun, and the inspiration that it gives. And speaking of inspiration, I have a very special guest today of whom I first met when I was staying in Taiwan for a couple months back, a couple years ago. And at that time, she was doing a story with Vice on the last indigenous spearfishing community on the southern part of the island. And so she, you know, invited me to come tag along. I was like, pfft. Of course, please, I want to see this. And we got to see unique rituals being done, traditions that have been carried over for decades. And it was a very unique experience. And their ritual traditions were very interesting indeed. They were sacrifice rituals. And well, they all looked at me as the volunteer. No, I'm just kidding. What happened, or what I witnessed, was the ritual of the white chicken to the sea. To have abundance for the year's harvest of fish from the sea, they would row out their boat past the waves, there's just like a wood-made craft from bamboo, I believe. It was several years ago. But anyway, they would bring a white chicken adorned for this. And, you know, one of the guys from the tribe will carry the chicken with him and start rolling out past the waves. And he gets out there. And then he takes the chicken in both of his hands, stands up. You know, we see him on the horizon. And you just see this godly figure just with the white chicken in his hand. And then we're like, what's going to happen next? And he just throws it into the sea. And then there you saw the little chicken flap its wings up in the air. And then he just gets back down and turns around and starts rowing back to shore. I'm like, what? So that's the sacrifice. Okay. So that was the ritual for the tribe as a whole and for having an abundance. And there was another ritual for the kids where they had four ducks and four guys went out to the shore with the ducks in their hand and they just all at once take them and swing them up in the air, and then all the kids are all up in the line and then they start rushing after them. So the ritual with this was that the kids would rush and the first one to grab the duck was the winner of, I can't remember, luck or good fortune or just a meal for later that day. Anyway, it was something I've never seen before, and it was a very interesting experience, without a doubt. And they lived on staples, being seaweed from the shore and spearfishing. And this was at night, so, you know, they would go out with lights, and man, I have a very intense phobia of dark waters, especially at night. All starting when I was a kid watching Jaws and not being able to bathe for a whole year straight. Anyway, my hat's off to them. But all in seriousness, this tribe lived in harmonious connection with each other and with their surroundings, and it was very inspirational to be part, even for only a couple days, of this indigenous community. And this was all thanks to my friend Clarissa and our guest today for opening up this reality to me. And since parting ways after that experience, I ended up moving down to Panama, and she has continued to seek after these types of experiences throughout mostly Asia. And I've connected her with a good childhood friend of mine, Matt, and another friend of ours, Curtis, of which they've met up with her when she was traveling in mainland China and went through Tibet, and I remember Matt coming back saying, "Yeah, no, we got to see a sky ritual of which the Tibetans would leave their dead up in a cliff for the vultures to eat away their body so that it could become integrated again with nature." Anywho, these are the types of experiences that Clarissa has written about, and she's written for National Geographic, Los Angeles Times, NPR, CNN, BBC, Vice, USA Today, Bon Appetit, Eater, CBS Los Angeles, Food Network, Sevior, and many others. So this person's on fire, as always is on fire, and I had a great time talking with her. So give it up, everybody. I hope you enjoy. So you would describe yourself as an American journalist. That's what you have on your website, right?
Yes.
Okay. Could you just summarize, I guess, your experiences or just general experiences, how you got into this and whatnot?
Yeah. So I'm an American journalist currently based out of Hong Kong. And I don't know how I got into this. I majored in journalism in college and have been traveling ever since and ended up getting a job in Hong Kong where my job is basically travel all over China and shoot videos about food and culture, which by many people's standards is a dream job. And it's been a really fun 2 years. That's kind of the short story of how I became a journalist.
Awesome. Don't worry, we'll get into the juicy details here soon. Well, let's just dive into that then. What would you say would be like one of those most memorable, most impactful experiences you've had?
I mean, from a sustainability perspective, I guess that's what I'll focus on, and then we can maybe go narrower or more general. I actually found a village where people compost using their human waste, and that field is still like a burial site for people. So it doubles as a vegetable field, a human manure area, and a graveyard. So that was definitely really surreal.
Whoa. And how long have they been doing that for?
I mean, hundreds of years. I'm not exactly sure, but that village, I went 4 years ago, and back then, very few people had actually left the village. So it's a thing that's been going on for centuries.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's like pretty rare now, I think, to find a village in China that isn't connected to the outside world because it's expanding so fast and there's a lot of infrastructure, but this village is quite surreal. Yeah, I don't think that really exists anywhere else, or if it is, it's like super taboo.
Mm-hmm. How many villages would you say you've visited overall?
Oh, I don't even know. I've been to over 21 provinces now, and there's like 33 or 34, so I have no recollection. But I think I've visited quite a bit. And a diverse type, like a lot of different types of villages from like the far west to the far east to the south.
And do they all have similarities amongst all of them, or each and every one vastly differ from one another?
I think what's similar is that there's a sense of communal sharing. So I was just in one in Yunnan where there was one spring for the entire village. And as early as 10 years ago, everyone had to walk down to the spring to fetch their water for the day. And so maintaining the viability and health of that spring was really important for the villagers. And they had joint bamboo groves that everyone sort of had to manage and maintain themselves. But every family would get a cut of the land. So I think that's been really fascinating for me, how these villages traditionally have, you know, communal resources, and they sort of figured it out among them, like who gets what. So that's the similarity I see among most villages, traditional villages in China.
And have you seen the development of modern China overtake a lot of these villages as they expand?
I mean, what happens is that a lot of young people don't come back, and sometimes they'll be turned into touristy sites, like tourist attractions. And when that happens, the web of the village is completely destroyed and income is based off of visitors coming. So it's completely ruined when that happens. So the places that still sort of retain that communal vibe where people are, you know, aware of their resources and helping each other out, those places are not touristy places. And sadly, they're getting harder to find, I think.
You haven't seen any villages or people still cultivating with hemp by any chance?
No, I haven't. Yunnan is sort of like where marijuana started, I believe, or like that plant originates from there. And I was talking to people, and a lot of people were like, oh yeah, this just grew wild everywhere when we were kids and whatnot. And I'm sure they have hemp. I know it's a traditional thing there, but I haven't noticed it in particular.
Yeah, statistically, China's like the number one leading producer of hemp. So it's
yeah.
so crazy because nobody knows anything about it.
Yeah, I'm sure people like produce clothes out of it in Yunnan. I just haven't dived as deep there. The last village I went to, the woman I was interviewing, like she made clothes out of tree bark, and it was like a raincoat that they used before there was, you know, modern synthetic material. So I'm sure
Whoa.
Hemp was really big for them.
Oh wow! And I did see that you met the an influencer of China. What,
yeah.
Who
That's
was
the girl
that?
I'm talking about. Her name is Dianqi Xiaoge. She's yeah, she does these like crazy cooking videos where she just, you know, makes everything from scratch and grows it and cooks it on a wood fire stove. And I think it's quite fascinating because for them, it's like nothing special. It's just what they grew up with. But for people who grew up in the cities or are a little bit removed from that farm life, it's like quite spectacular. I mean, even for Americans who grew up in a rural area, like what Chinese people do is no one really does that anymore. Like their entire stove is heated with, you know, firewood that they get and they don't use gas. I mean, obviously they have access to it now, but traditionally they just hack down pine and bamboo and then they heat it and they're really good at telling like how hot the fire is based off of that. And they're so good at making preserves and different types of pickles and dried meats and whatnot. So the knowledge there is incredible. And I don't think enough of it has been documented enough.
Wow.
Yeah.
Would you say that the knowledge has only been kept with the older folks, or has some of that been passed down to the younger generations?
I think so. The woman that I interviewed was quite young. She was 28, 29. So it has stayed with the younger generation. But the thing is, most young people, even if they know this, they won't teach it to their kids, you know, because these younger people, they'll go to university and they'll get a job in the city and they won't necessarily return to the countryside. So it is a dying thing, though I do feel like people, I mean, this is inevitable of any country as the middle class expands. I think people are starting to sort of value their culture and return to that. But by and large, I think most people aren't that interested in it.
Yeah. I was just going to ask, because usually across countries, across cultures, that, you know, living on a farm or working on a farm has always, you know, recently been associated with being poor or being lower class, uneducated.
Yeah.
So that's been, is that, would you say, the predominant current paradigm of thinking there in China?
Yes, but there's also like the phenomenon that there are these farm influencers. Besides Dianqi Xiaoge, there's another woman called Li Ziqi who has like I think 3 times more followers than her, and she's considered like a national treasure of China, and all she does is, you know, show these videos where I think her most famous one was when she made a chair out of bamboo, and she like harvested the bamboo herself and like cured it and like put the whole thing together. So I think now, because of the internet and because there are young people who know how to put together videos and content, there's a different type of appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
But whether or not that will change anything, I'm not so sure. It's more like people say watching these people in the farm is a bit like watching a fairy tale or like watching a fake story. There's not a real connection in that mm-hmm. sense.
Yeah. Do you remember how they cure their bamboo by any chance?
I don't, but I can send you the video.
Oh,
she shows
yes.
She shows every single step, which is, yeah, that's the cool thing about these videos. They show every single step of how they build these things.
Okay. What have you experienced in China that you just don't see in other parts of the world?
Let me think. A lot of things. I mean, last time when I was in the Tibetan area, I think that was around when, like, Matthew and Curtis came to visit. We saw a sky burial, which is, like, dead bodies are put out into the field and then like vultures eat them. So
that's right.
I don't think that happens anywhere else in the world. I've been to some of these villages where they like grow their own indigo and cotton and like still weave their own clothes from scratch. And I think that's the cool thing about China. I'm sure it's the same in Latin America too. It's just development has happened so rapidly within the course of the last 10 to 15 years that you can still see remnants of traditional culture. What Chinese people do with tofu. So, like, I feel like everywhere else in the world, tofu is just, you get a block of hard tofu in the grocery store, or you might have soy milk, but tofu is very similar to cheese in China. So they'll ferment it, or they'll inoculate it so that hairs grow. So it's very similar to tempeh, but this one is called hairy tofu.
Oh.
And it's just super diverse. There's so many
Yeah.
types of preserved tofu, and it tastes like blue cheese, or,
Really?
it's amazing. And it's like dairy isn't a traditional part of many people's diets in China. Obviously, now with globalization, everyone has access to milk and cheese, but traditionally it was all with tofu, and that fulfilled the function of cheese, which I find really cool.
And what have you observed in regards to the health of these villagers, of these villages you've visited? Do they seem pretty healthy? What was
Yeah,
your impression?
they seem extremely healthy and just strong. When I was in Yunnan filming Dianxi Xiaoge, like, she's my age, and she's able to do everything with a cleaver, like a really heavy cleaver, and she minced a full chunk of beef into patties just using the cleaver. And it's like she gave me a cleaver to try it alongside her. And what was amazing was, like, I was not even close, like, compared to her in terms of how much energy and strength she has. So
Wow.
they're just really strong. And yeah, even the old people, I mean, they like carry things from the mountains and are constantly chopping up bones and whatnot, and like axing down bamboo and trees. And that's been a consistent theme, honestly, throughout my travels. I know in like Taiwan, I went to an indigenous tribe, and they're like, oh, let's harvest some bamboo and like make some cups because we're bored. And like, it was so hard for me, but for them, they're like, whatever, here, like cut, cut, and there you have it. They just make it look really easy.
Yeah. And their happiness, what would you say you've observed in terms of these villagers' happiness?
I think it's just more contentment. I mean, it's hard to conclude as an outsider because obviously I don't know what it's like, but I think there is more of a contentment. You see the older generation, they're not, vying to go out or travel. They're just, that's their life, and that's the way it has always been. And I do think now a lot of people in China who have had grandparents grow up in that situation and they have seen it, there's a sort of nostalgia for that type of life. When I was interviewing this influencer, she said a lot of the comments on her videos were like, oh, I wish I could go back to my old village and do exactly what you're doing. Like, what a dream. So I think there is a longing for a more simpler life, from city people at least.
Yeah, and common shared struggles. Would you say there were any commonalities of some struggles that the villages shared?
With city people or with.
Or just in general, like day in the life, say, like for me now, I would say, okay, the struggle is, let's say like traffic or, mean people, whatever. What would you say that someone from these villages would say? Like, what's hard about your lifestyle right now?
Well, I think it's like selling their products, right? When they're the village I was just at, they have tobacco, and that's like a state-owned business. So companies will come and like buy it up, and they don't really have to think about marketing. But for like, I was in a this isn't a village, but I was in a town where everyone does teapots. And when everyone does teapots, it's like, oh, how do I even distinguish myself? Like, how do I sell it? Because before, all of these like teapot factories were state-owned companies, so they didn't have to think about marketing. But now, it's super capitalistic, and everyone has to think about how to sell their goods and market it. And that's sort of the struggle for these traditional villages too. Like, they have to earn a source of income, and just going to the local wet market for a lot of people simply isn't enough anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's where the internet comes in. Like, a lot of people are doing, live streaming shows where they like show how they make their teapot, and then you can buy it from them while they're live streaming and whatnot. So it is interesting to see how technology is playing a role in how their lives develop.
And how would you foresee the near future, and maybe even distant future of China?
Again, I think there will be more value placed on these like traditional arts and knowledge. And I think because of a growing wave of nationalism within China, this just further helps that. People are really proud to be Chinese, and they're really proud of their arts and their food and their culture. So from a cultural perspective, I do think there will be more people who are into it. But I feel like it'll sort of be like what it's like in the States, where it's kind of like a new wave bougie hipster movement, which is very unfortunate, I think. But unlike in the States, there are more like young people, there are more old people who can pass down this knowledge. Because I feel like in the States, it's really hard to even find someone to be like, oh, this is a wild vegetable in, you know, Oregon or in California. A lot of that has been lost. Like, but in China, it's quite common still. So that's really encouraging.
Yeah, I know. With American culture, I think it's been severed a while back now.
Yeah.
Now, when you go onto your website, it's quite impressively overwhelming of the amount of like experiences and work you've done. Mm. And I've kind of looked at some of your highlights, and kind of there's a lot of things that caught my eye. I know we won't have time to go through every single one of them, so I just jotted down a few of them to ask about how it was. Like, for example, you know, I saw the piece on the goji berry capital of China.
Yeah.
What was that all about? What was that like?
It was just a town I went to where everyone was growing goji berries. And like, that's very common in China. Like, you'll just jump off the train and then you'll see like a bunch of teapot signs everywhere. And you're like, oh, this is the teapot capital of China. Like, this place in Ningxia was the goji berry capital of China. So I actually didn't spend that much time there. It was just half a day. And I just went off, and you saw in the markets everyone was selling goji berry. But what was cool was I found a different type of goji berry I had never seen in the West, which is a dark blue type of goji berry. And the reason why it's not heavily marketed outside of China, it's because they haven't been able to domesticate the plant, so it's quite wild. Goji berries, I think, traditionally have a bunch of thorns on it, but they've been able to domesticate it so that the red ones don't have thorns. But this black one, this blue-black one, still is quite thorny, and it's harder to predict how much stock you have. So they actually just sell it among themselves or within China, but you can't really get it elsewhere. So that's like been a common theme, I think, in my travels, where I'll see a plant that everyone knows in the States, but then you'll see other varieties that you don't get outside of China just because they're harder to grow, or they're some sort of heirloom variety that's difficult to export.
Interesting. What climate was that in?
It was like a dry, like arid and dry, and it gets quite cold. And I think it was the difference between the temperatures. It gets really hot during the day and cold at night, that like that was the reason why goji berries were quite good.
Wow.
Over there. Yeah.
Tasted them too, right?
Yeah. I mean, they didn't taste any different. Well, I mean, I guess fresh goji berries taste completely different from the dried ones we get in the States. They taste more like a berry. The ones that we get in the States are dried, obviously. So they don't have as much of a sweet and juicy flavor. So it was cool trying one fresh off the shrub.
Now, I really enjoyed reading one of your articles that you've written about the young learning the indigenous ways of hunting in Taiwan. Could you tell us a little bit about that? You know, how did you come across and meeting these people in the first place?
So those are my friends. I like woofed in Taiwan for 2-3 weeks. And the son of the lady I was staying with, like, they go up to the mountains very often, but guns are illegal in Taiwan. So they actually make their own guns, which is super risky.
What?
It's crazy. And it's one of those things where only men can go up, and it's a very like spiritual experience. And they'll go up in the mountains and hunt for, you know, feral hogs and deer. And what I learned is that it's kind of a rite of initiation to become a man in this tribe, and actually in a lot of tribes in Taiwan. And they'll just go out and bring very little things with them besides, you know, their gun. They might bring a tarp and just like sleep under a tree and whatnot. And it's kind of cool because it's like a youth group type of deal where, you know, the elders will arrange an excursion out to the mountains and you just tag along. So again, it's that like sense of community and knowledge being passed down from elder to younger generation. And they only hunt at night because the animals come out at night. And they said you can tell, like, you can see the animals by seeing their eyes, because their eyes will light up and whatnot.
Wow.
Yeah. Huh? Oh, and there's a whole, like, movement now with indigenous people, kids in Taiwan, who want to return to the villages. Because it's a very similar story to the Native American tribes in America, where it's, like, these places are poor. There's incidences of alcoholism, and you know, it's just a very tattered community now because of colonization. But there are young people who want to go back, and so now I've been seeing, I talked to a couple of people, people are arranging like hikes to their ancestral towns, and these towns are in the mountains, and Taiwan's super mountainous, so sometimes it'll take a month to like trek through the mountain to get to where their ancestral village is, and they'll just stay there for a month and then come back down. And if you can imagine the logistics of even doing that, and these places don't have trails to them, so people, they will like make a rope out of what's that? It's similar to bamboo. It starts with an R. I can't think of it right now. They'll make
reed?
Ropes. Reed. So close though. So similar to bamboo.
Oh.
It's okay. I'll think of it. But they'll just basically make their own ropes while they're like hiking and like go down cliffs and whatnot. And it's all led by like an old guy who like remembers, or his dad told him how to get to the village. So I think that's kind of cool. It's like a journey back home.
Wow.
And, yeah, and it's crazy how long it takes too, because when you look at Taiwan, it doesn't seem like that big of a place, but it's incredibly mountainous, and the mountains are quite wild, and there are places that are really inaccessible. So they'll make that trek and, you know, hunt for food while they're at it.
How does the elder tell the young person where to go? Like, it's like, oh, you get to this cliff, then they make a right? Or
the young person will take them. I mean, sorry, the elder will take the young person. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And I actually, my friend Lily, who's the woman I stayed with, like her dad, I still remember is like living in the ancestral village. And he was telling me like he used to run barefoot between villages. Like, and I was like, how did you have light? Because he would run barefoot between villages at night to deliver messages. And he would use a bamboo pole as a torch to like light his way. And that was really common for them, that as a man, you wouldn't walk, you would run between villages.
Why run and not walk?
It's just faster that way, I suppose. Yeah, and like I think I heard in like the Mojave Desert in California, like the Native American tribes there also ran a lot to deliver messages between tribes. So it's kind of cool to see the common themes between indigenous tribes. Obviously, this is all just what people tell me. I can't really verify it, but it is interesting.
Yeah, and it's very interesting too, like the rite of passage that you described. You know, I feel like that's a very important piece of our own lives that's been missing nowadays, and where people subconsciously, I feel people kind of seek that out in their own ways, like whether that's gangs for teenagers or whatever. You know, it's very interesting to hear like real life examples that are still in still in practice today of going through those rites of passages.
Yeah, and just mentorship as well, because you know, in the villages, the women, they learn how to cook all of these dishes and assemble all of these crazy, you know, crafts and arts because their grandmothers teach them or their mothers teach them, and that's slowly being lost. So yeah, like having that sense of community and like people to teach you is important, because you really just can't do it yourself. It's like all of this comes from hundreds of years of knowledge and that your ancestors learned and whatnot. So when you have that broken line, that's when these traditions start to die.
Totally. It's like, I mean, you could get, you know, second best, you know, from books, internet, whatnot, but it's kind of like how a baby cow learns how to eat grass from a mother cow. It's just like, you know, without even exchanging a word, it's just by assimilation or observation, whatever, you know, whatever you want to describe it as. And I feel like that's such an important piece of learning these old ways, you know. So Clarissa, I wanted to talk to you briefly about a very interesting article that you've written for Vice called "We Can Feed the World with Kelp Forests." I just put up the article here. It says, with just under 4 acres of ocean, kelp farmers can average about 200,000 pounds of mussels and 500 pounds of dried kelp each year. Could you talk a little bit about that? Who is the entity doing that operation?
It's called Green Wave. So I went to Maine and I interviewed someone who has this company called Green Wave, and they're just starting kelp forests and helping small farmers start their own kelp forests. Kelp is one of the most sustainable crops or food that we can be eating, and it requires zero to very little inputs. So it's cool that this is happening in America. And this company that I profiled, they are helping small farmers along the coast get into it. And I think someone in California actually started a kelp farm. And it's cool because it not only grows food, but it creates an ecosystem where you can also grow shellfish and whatnot at the bottom of these forests.
Wow. Kelp has a lot of like essential minerals and vitamins that we simply just cannot get anywhere else.
Yeah, and you can use it as fertilizer. It's a really good food source. And like, what's great about this is like, you just need a small little boat, I think. Like, it doesn't require a lot of input, and you don't have to fertilize it. You just put it out in the ocean, and that completely solves the problem of, you know, like aquaculture farms that are super destructive. You can, with these kelp forests, you can have not only a nutritious source of food, which is the kelp, but you can also like have shellfish and whatnot, which shellfish helps filter out the water, some of them, so that it provides a mutual beneficial relationship.
And wasn't that like a staple too of that indigenous tribe that we visited in Taiwan, kind of like of seaweed or kelp or whatever it was?
Yeah. So that tribe in Taiwan, they will forage it, and that's one of those things that are slowly being lost, because it's like the women will go out and forage at certain times of the year, and they'll only teach people within that tribe. It's really cool because like foraging for kelp, there's so many different varieties that you can eat and whatnot. And so that tribe, they do eat kelp. It's not a staple though. It's one of those seasonal things, kind of like mushrooms, but only the women know how to forage it. So there's assigned roles. Like the women will know how to forage certain things, but they won't know how to hunt, but the men know how to hunt. And I think by dividing all of this up, it's really quite helpful.
Yeah, that was a very interesting place where it was a matriarch society in some sense, where the ladies were the decision makers, so to speak.
Yeah, I think so. Again, it was so long, but it's not uncommon to find matriarchal societies within Asia. They're just not very talked about.
Yeah. Now, there's an article that I've always been wanting to talk to you about that you've written that really caught my curiosity, my fascination. The one which you've titled The Unsung Story of the Chinese and Japanese Immigrants Who Brought Rice to California. How exactly did that happen?
Yeah, so that was actually quite cool doing that story. Sacramento in Northern California is a huge place for rice growing. And right now, if you go up there, it's a lot of like Irish Americans, white Americans growing rice. But the whole story was that like Chinese people were forced there because of discrimination. And when they saw the land, they cried. And they slowly, with the Japanese, ended up finding a variety of rice that was able to grow in the soil. And the soil is like hard pan clay, and it's really bad for rice. And it's just not the same thing. But they eventually like found a variety, and like the rice industry flourished. But with discrimination and the internment camps for the Japanese, all of that land was taken back, not taken back, but taken away from the Japanese farmers who were there. So when the Japanese people came back from the internment camps, all their land was gone and they didn't have access to growing rice anymore. So it's a weird part of history. And there's still one Japanese family that does it. I think it's called Kota Farms, but they're a bit south from the main rice growing areas.
Okay.
Yeah. Quite interesting how people will carry their culture or their food staples wherever they go. And even if that area isn't conducive to growing, you know, their staple like rice, they'll figure out a way to do it just through, you know, generations of experimentation.
Yeah. And I think that's what makes it so interesting, like particularly in North America, where you would have in gardening or whatever, I think you could break everything down into like new world crops and old world crops. Basically, like those brought in from Europe back in the day and those that were from, you know, Mesoamerica or whatnot, and just like the evolution convergence of those two. But ultimately, they had their like two separate stems or of origin. So it's quite interesting to kind of see how all that evolves over time. Just, you know, kind of with any like, I guess you could say invasive species or non-invasive species, whatever. I mean, everything kind of just like circles around throughout time, and just kind of interesting to see the evolution of all that stuff take place.
Yeah.
So Clarissa, you've traveled all over the place, and, you know, especially Asia, the part of the world that I know the least about. What has been, you know, some common themes or realizations that you've concluded from your experience?
So I think the common theme throughout all my travels is that there's a lot of knowledge to be found in indigenous tribes. And I think these indigenous tribes these places aren't just some like touristy thing you can drop in at and like watch some sing and dance or like buy a touristy souvenir from them. There's a lot of knowledge that they have that can be applied to our daily lives and in big cities as well. So like when I was in Taiwan, I learned about, and they don't call it these things, but they have natural nitrogen fixing plants that could be used, you know, in the city. And it's interesting the way they see it. It's just like, oh, you plant this and it'll help your soil and whatnot, or you can grow this along the tree. And even when I was in like Ecuador, they had these things called chakras, which was like 2 hectares of land where they like grew all these vegetables in symbiotic relationships. And to them, it was like nothing. But imagine if we applied that knowledge to our cities or our suburbs, it would be, you know, extraordinary and could change things. So I think there's a lot of lessons to be derived. And I think in my travels, it's always so inspiring. You know, you can read so many books about this or, you know, go on YouTube and see what young people are doing. But mm-hmm. just going back to these old villages and talking to an old person and just having them tell you what their daily life is, you'll learn so much more than you can from a book. So there's so much value to these places. And not only preserving them, I think preserving them at this point is, I don't want to say a lost cause, but the matter of the fact is like the world is changing and development is happening. But if we can just extract lessons from these places and apply it to our daily lives in the cities or the suburbs, I think it could change so much.
Totally. Man, I'm always inspired talking with you, Clarissa. How can listeners get in touch with you and see what you're up to these days?
Everything is mostly on my website, which is okay. ClarissaWay.com, but social media, Instagram, I suppose. Yeah, okay. We'll see what happens. I don't know where I'm going to go or what's going to happen, but I do think I will continue, you know, going to these villages and learning from people as much as possible before all of this disappears.
Totally. Well, I think what you're doing is very important work. So yeah, keep at it.
Thank you. Good catching up with you again as well.
Always. Thanks again. This was awesome.
Yeah.
I love doing this. Yeah. Likewise.
And keep in touch.
Okay. For sure.
All right.
Have a good one. Bye-bye. There you have it, folks. That is Clarissa Way for you. Don't forget to visit her website, show her some of your love, and check out all the awesome work that she's up to. If you enjoyed this podcast episode, or even if you didn't, please leave a review and a comment on whatever platform you're listening to this on. And also, if you would like to get featured, send us a voicemail as well through our anchor.fm link. I would love to hear from you. Now, there is no better way to wrap this up than with some good old inspired beats created by the almighty Michael Kinney.